Blog Talk Radio.
Take my love, take my land, take me where I cannot stand. I don't care, I'm still free. You can't take the sky from me. Take me out to the black. Tell them I ain't coming back. Burn the land and boil the sea. You can't take the sky from me. There's no place I can be since I found serenity. You can't take the sky from me.
Good evening. You are live on the Tex and Rex Show Christmas special. Irreverent, relevant, and radioactive conservatism with a bite. I'm your host, Rex, broadcasting to you from the Imperial City, and my co-host, Tex, is on special assignment, so I am flying solo tonight. Just wanted to give a shout-out with the call-in number, 646-649-1013. That's 646-649-1013. Feel free to call in. It's going to be a relaxed show this evening because we are about one day away from Christmas. And there's a lot going on, but Washington, D.C. is quiet and asleep because all the congressional critters and the imperial president have left town, which is kind of interesting that they're all spending money flying back home and the president's spending God knows how much on his Christmas vacation. And I don't begrudge anybody a Christmas vacation, but they left a lot of unfinished business when they skipped town. They're home. You've got their numbers. If you don't, use the Google, figure out what their numbers are, and call them and tell them that they had better fix it. Well, it is the 23rd of December. It is one day before Christmas Eve, so we are in the last week of Advent, which is only going to last one day because tomorrow evening is Christmas Eve. And I want to wish everybody a Merry Christmas on behalf of the Tex and Rex Show, and want to kind of bring up some Christmas carols. The Christmas Carol is a story you've probably read or at least seen movie variations of it by Charles Dickens, where a miserly, quote, capitalist Ebenezer Scrooge is visited by his former partner who's deceased as a ghost, Jacob Marley. Not to be confused with Bob Marley, because that would have been quite a different trip. But he visits Scrooge in the middle of the night, frightens him, and tells him that he'll be visited by three ghosts. The ghosts of Christmas past, Christmas present, and Christmas future. And throughout the story, Scrooge goes from being a miserly curmudgeon to receiving the Christmas spirit and changing his heart, which is what Christmas is really about. And we have to always hold out hope that the congressional critters and other Washington morons may one day have a change of heart and actually do something honest and true. I wouldn't hold my breath, but we can certainly have that hope. Well, in that spirit tonight, we are going to visit the ghosts of Republicans past and the ghosts of Republicans present and maybe think about what ghosts of Republican future might look like. And when I say Republican, obviously I'm really speaking conservatism, but the brand name of conservatism happens to be the Republican Party for now. In the future, that may change. We'll see what happens. But one thing to keep in mind, and this is a fascinating part about the story, is the ghost of Christmas past shows Scrooge things that Scrooge has forgotten. And that's pretty important because I've got to tell you something. Conservatives, who allegedly are traditionalists and backwards and looking back instead of forward and saying no to every change, as opposed to progressives who are always looking forward, conservatives forget a lot of their history. And that's terrible. In fact, Americans in general don't know our own history, and that's why we are where we are. So it is very important to always look back and kind of see the things that you forgot and learn from the mistakes of the past. But then you've got to look at the present. because you got to know where you are so that you can figure out how to get to where you want to go. Then the interesting thing about any kind of future prophecy or future time travel like we see in some of the movies, the future is unwritten. Now, prophecy, from a biblical standpoint, closed with the death of the last apostle, St. John, and since then, prophecy has been contingent, meaning that revelation was closed with the death of the last apostle, and that is about the extent of specific revelation and future prophecies that we will get. And since then, any kind of prophetic statement is always contingent. But what's it contingent on? It's contingent upon temporal affairs. So if you see the future, it is unwritten, and it is merely a warning. And how you react now, how you act now, is going to dictate what that future is. Because we can look prophetically forward and see that, you know, the picture for this country, it don't look so good. And there are a lot of dire warnings, and there are a lot of things to be concerned about. But we can either succumb to despair and do nothing about it, or we can take those future prophetic warnings and act properly now to change the future disposition. And that's what we're going to try to do on this trip tonight. We've got our first caller in from the Coalition of Freedom on Facebook, and I recommend you go to that website. Just type in Coalition of Freedom in your Facebook search, and you will find the page. Join the group. Trog, you are live with Rex. How are you?
Excellent. I'm doing a reading a term paper right now.
It's pretty powerful stuff.
I was given an assignment.
Well, if you're in the Blog Talk Radio chat, I just posted an article from Newt Gingrich published on Gingrich Productions. If not, just Google it and you'll find it. It is a memo that he wrote for the challenges confronting the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty powerful, pretty deep. And we'll probably get into some of it tonight, but it is only a two-hour show, and it is one day before Christmas. So I don't know how deep we'll get into it, and we might extend it into the future. But it is very powerful. And the thing about Newt Gingrich, I was worried about where he was going to go after the election. Because, you and I know what he did before. We honor him for what he did, and we thank him. And, every American should thank him, whether you like him or not. What he did in the 90s delayed where we are today by about 15 years. Because had Clinton gotten his way, we wouldn't need Obama, because we would have already been here. Then he kind of, endorsed or supported Mitt Romney, which just, bugged the hell out of all of us conservatives. But, and there's debate about it, Chris, but I think that Newt did that in order to keep the conservative message alive and also to ensure that he had the opportunity to speak and be part of the process of fixing the party after Romney failed, which, even though Newt says that, he predicted a Romney landslide and then he says, I was wrong, I don't think he ever believed that Romney was going to win.
I don't think so either.
No.
I think he's being polite, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think he's playing ball. I mean, he says that this memo he wrote was at the request of Chairman Prince Pubic, which, I doubt that very much. Why the hell would Prince Pubis ask Newt Gingrich to write a memo about the challenges facing the Republican Party when clearly, little Prince Pubic just has no desire to do anything conservative in the Republican Party? So, but I think that Newt's, nodding towards those who currently have positions in the party as kind of a respect for the office they hold, even though
sure.
seriously doubt he respects them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's kind of – when you see, I'm halfway through this thing because I'm highlighting and making notes and things like that, so that I can respond quickly because it is a lot of information. But when you read this, you realize that these guys probably can't even dissect this because they're so narrow-minded in their view of what they thought they were doing and for the numbers of rules and laws that they broke and terrible things they did through the whole primary and at the RNC convention. I don't think they're smart enough to recognize what Newt's writing here, to be honest with you.
Probably not, and I think that a lot of people would miss it because I think Newt is brilliant in the way he gets a message across. I mean, first, he can be really pithy and very direct, and then second of all, he can actually communicate a specific point, especially an unpopular point, in such a way as to not allow feathers to be ruffled about the point while he makes the point. And I think what he's doing here, he's speaking in a way that would belay the concerns of rhinos. But he's speaking directly to conservatives, if you know what you're looking for, which I think is very powerful. And I actually think he's speaking a lot to authentic Tea Party. Not the appropriated Boehner Tea Party, but the real authentic Tea Party that started when Bush screwed up. And I also think he's speaking quite clearly to the Ron Paul revolution. Yeah, I know that a lot of the Ron Paulers think that Newt's like, super ultimate neocon, the grand architect of the New World Order. But the fact is he's speaking to Ron Paulers because I think that Newt respects Ron Paul and always has. They worked together for a long time. I just, there are some significant differences. I would argue that, Newt's foreign policy is far more neocon than Ron Paul's would ever be. But as far as conservatism goes, I think that they're more or less on the same page as making the Republican Party more conservative and making it the big tent that Reagan managed to build a coalition on. And I think he talks a lot about coalition.
Constitutionally.
Yeah.
I think that's the key word.
Yeah, I agree.
You know what I mean?
He uses the word coalition a lot, which is also the name of your group on Facebook, Coalition. And it's also, basically the reason Tex and I got on the air was we were trying to build a coalition between, Reagan Gingrich conservatives and, Ron Paul conservatives to get the brokered convention. And I knew a lot of Newt people who just hated Ron Paul. I mean, a lot of Ron Paul people who hated Newt. And I was thinking to myself, what is wrong with these people? How did they get so divided? I mean, yes, there are significant differences, but there are far more similarities. And right now, we're so far, behind the goal line that we need to form coalitions where we can, because the enemy is so well entrenched within the party and the opposition. So it's kind of interesting that he uses the word coalition a lot. So I think that's who he was reaching out to. And in our trip tonight, because you and I are going we're going on a magical Christmas trip. And anybody who wants to call in and join us, 646-649-1013. So the ghost of Republicans past. And I think this is very important because a lot of people, especially, Gingrich conservatives or Kaine conservatives or Perry conservatives, I guess, or even Little Ricky Santorum conservatives, they pride themselves on being in the Reagan mold, right? But they've never really looked back at the party because I don't think that they know where true conservatism was. In fact, I think it was we played the clip last week from Rosie O'Donnell. Not Rosie O'Donnell, that other lesbian, Larry O'Donnell. Is that his name? Larry or Chris? I don't know, whatever. Anyway, we played that clip where he said that, that Reagan couldn't win the GOP primary today. Well, I would agree with that. He couldn't win because they would marginalize him faster than they did last time. They tried to derail him in 1980, but I think this time they'd succeed the way they did with Paul and Gingrich. But he also said the Republicans have forgotten who even, Reagan is and what he did. And I will agree with that wholeheartedly. So I think it's important to go back in time. And in fact, I'm going to go back, so far back, Chris, that you and I are going to find ourselves not in the 20th century, but in the 19th century. And we're going to go back to President McKinley. And we're going to listen to his 1896 campaign speech. Not the whole thing. I got about a minute of it. So here's President McKinley in 1896 while he was campaigning.
My fellow citizens, recent events have imposed upon the patriotic people of this country a responsibility and a duty greater than that of any since the Civil War. Then it was a struggle to preserve the government of the United States. Now it is a struggle to preserve the financial honor of the government. Our creed embraces an honest dollar, an untarnished national credit, adequate revenues for the uses of the government, protection to labor and industry, preservation of the home market, and reciprocity, which will extend our foreign market. Upon this platform we stand, and submit its declaration to the sober and considerate judgment of the American people.
Now, I know that audio was a little hard for us to handle because, you know, it is 1896, folks. So that was like an
edit. Did he really talk like that? That's really him?
Yeah, that's an actual recording that was done by Thomas Edison on one of his, you know, wax recording devices. I think it was even before, you know, vinyl or anything else was used in the phonographs, and that was actually McKinley. So we really went to the
interesting way of speaking, didn't he?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would argue that it probably wasn't that unusual in the 19th century. Just a little different to our ears. You know, sort of like when you read the Constitution, some of the words that they use seem a little flowery for us today, but the fact is that if we understand it in context, it's very powerful stuff. What I found fascinating about this is that he was talking about an honest dollar and the financial honor of government, meaning a government that spends within its means. That's a pretty Republican principle going back, at least as far as 1896.
That's why they shot him.
Yeah. Yeah, well,
shot him because he refused to. He stuck to the gold standard, and he refused to let them pull an inflationary maneuver on the economy. Did you study that?
Yeah, giddy up! I mean, you nailed it. It's absolutely true, and it's kind of interesting when we say, you know, they shot him. Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is that at the time, and look, this is the thing about the banksters. They always play both sides of the equation. They win no matter which way you go, and. So they hedged that the gold standard may remain, okay? But they were hoping to promote Jennings, Bryan, and the Democratic Party with, quote, a silver-based money as opposed to gold-based money. Now, I'm not necessarily opposed to bimetallism, but silver allows for more inflation than gold because it is generally easier to get. In fact, no one really goes mining for silver. You usually go mining for gold, but along the way you find silver. So there was some confusion at the time, but basically the other side, quote, the populist side, was actually inflationist, and the gold standard was to keep the dollar honest. Now, the Morgans also were interested in getting behind the gold standard, but not with any intent of keeping it as a gold standard. They were intending to set up a central bank, take all the gold, and then base their fiat paper regime on the gold, which they didn't do in 1896, but it wasn't that many years later that they did it. In fact, they went for that secret meeting at Jekyll Island, Georgia in 1910. So when we think 1896 to 1910, that's just, you know, 14 years. Where were we 14 years ago? Oh, that's right. The year, you know, 1999. What did we do in 1999? We ousted Newt Gingrich. Why would we do that? Oh, the Republicans ousted Newt Gingrich because they wanted to spend money, and what did they do since then? They went on a spending binge. So it's pretty fascinating, but we really got to think about that because, in reality, the Republican Party was kind of more a central bank party. There was kind of a shift here, you know, with McKinley to hold up a gold standard, which I think is a pretty important point. So that's where we are in the past, and it gets even more interesting because, you know, we talk about sound money, right? Why do we talk about sound money? Because that is the way we measure our growth, our wealth, our interactions. And, of course, if the dollar is being inflated, that means that someone's counterfeiting and taking the wealth away. And we know who they are. Principally, it is, you know, obviously the Federal Reserve, Wall Street bankers, government contractors, chiefly in the military-industrial complex that another Republican, Dwight D. Eisenhower, warned us about. So generally, when we move away from sound money, we also move towards foreign intervention. Now, keep in mind, 1896, you've got to put things in perspective when you're talking history. 1896 is barely 3 decades from the end of the war for Southern independence. So, you know, when we think back to Vietnam, okay, that's the way these people thought back to, quote, the Civil War. You know, it wasn't that long ago. So, you know, That was a war that was, you know, not fun. 600,000 Americans died. It ravaged the country, possibly lost us our state's sovereignty. And,
yeah, I was
going to
say, we wrote to democracy.
Yeah. So, you know, pretty interesting stuff. But nevertheless, that was essentially, even though I believe it was a war between two countries, the United States of America and the Confederate States of America, we refer to it in the vernacular as a civil war, but it was kind of an internecine conflict. It was an American conflict. We did little in the way of foreign conflicts at the time. You know, in 1776, we evicted a foreign government from our shores, the British government, did it again in 1812. So, you know, 1896, we still hadn't entered into that age of foreign interventionism. But we were getting there, and we were getting there pretty damn fast because we were starting to move away from sound money. And when you move away from sound money, you generally have to not only inflate, excuse me, but you also get into foreign entanglements because, you know, that's what banksters do. They want mercantilist trade, you know, corporatist trade. So that's what they're looking for. And here's an interesting Republican past. This is President Taft, chiefly on foreign policy. So just listen to this, and we'll see if we can link it to. It's pretty interesting.
I am willing to admit that war has accomplished much in the progress of the world. I'm willing to admit that there are certain crises in the forward march of Christian civilization that perhaps could not have been met in any other way than by the sword. I'm willing to admit that war develops certain heroic traits in men and furnishes a test for the evidence of the highest character. Perhaps, too, it trains and disciplines people. But the other side of the picture justifies the prayer of every man, of every civilized man, that war should be abolished. And that the suffering, cruelty, corruption, and demoralization that follow in its train should be, as far as we can bring it about, lifted as a burden from the human race. It is our duty to take every legitimate and proper step we can to persuade the nations of the world to settle their controversies in some other way. They are looking to us as a country independent of entangling alliances, separated from all possible attacks by two wide oceans, rich, powerful, and in a situation where nobody can accuse us of being afraid of any nation or of taking this step because we are afraid of war if war were a necessity. It is the common people of the world that are interested in this business. They know when we have war, it is they that have to bear the burden. It's their sisters and mothers and daughters that have to wait, trembling, to hear the news from the battlefield to learn whether their dear ones have bitten the dust. It's the great mass of the plain people that Lincoln loved so well that have to stand the brunt of war. They do not have the glory of coming home with the gold lace and the feathers and all that falls to the leaders. They are not elected presidents because they happen to be successful. They know the demoralization that follows in the wake of war. We should lead the way, and all doubts as to our constitutional authority should be resolved in favor of our stepping forward as a nation with the power, the wealth, the fortune, and the opportunity that God has given us to help along the movement of Christian progress toward permanent.
Interesting, no?
Mm.
What would happen if a president spoke like that today about Christian civilization and Christian progress by the gifts that God gave us? You know what I mean? I think that people would probably go absolutely bonkers over something like that. He's a theocrat. He's establishing a theocracy. They start freaking out. But that's pretty much how our presidents, both Democrats and Republicans, spoke and believed.
Well, yeah. Listen to Kennedy. Kennedy was more conservative and I would say spiritual or religious than most of the Republicans I listen to.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And I mean, look, the fascinating thing is Kennedy was around today, he'd be, you know, to the right of most Republicans.
I know.
Now, that was Taft, and that was let's see, he was president early part of the 20th century.
Yeah. 1909, 1913.
Yeah. So, you know,
I have a question.
Yeah.
I have a historical question on Taft for you. I'm reading as you throw out names, I automatically pull them up so I can, you know, scan through and be on top of it. But they said Taft had a lot to do with that 16th Amendment, even though that came in with the next guy, correct?
Yeah, there is some issues with it, but let's keep in mind something. The 16th Amendment doesn't do what we think it does. We've been conditioned to think that the 16th Amendment made the income tax legal, which it really doesn't. And I think the way that Taft understood it, it was not going to be an income tax. And remember something, you know, Taft did this before the banking bill was drafted, before the Fed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and you got to ask yourself, why did they boot him out? And why did, what's his name, Roosevelt, why did he get back in as, quote, the third-party spoiler, the bull moose, to bring in a rather manageable academic, you know, Woodrow Wilson? I mean, let's face it, you know, everybody blames Wilson for a lot of stuff. I know Judge Napolitano has a book out now about both Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson.
Right.
But Wilson really isn't the problem. Wilson was just the puppet, and let's face it, the true presidency of Woodrow Wilson was Edward Mandel House. I mean, Colonel House, the bankster guy, basically ran the Wilson administration, and that's how they managed to get all this stuff through. So, you know, technically the 16th Amendment doesn't allow for a direct income tax, which is nothing more than interest collected by the Federal Reserve on debt-backed money. But overall, I would say that Taft was probably one of our better presidents because, you know, he didn't do all that much as far as growing up the country.
He was also, it seems that he was groomed by, you know, the powers that be, you know, to with his involvement with McKinley and Philippines and the Spanish-American War issues. It seemed like they were really developing him for something big, and he got in there and got defeated.
Yep. Well, because the thing is, if you don't play ball, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, if you don't play ball with their agenda, they get rid of you. I mean, that's what they do. Because, you know, the corporatist agenda must go on, and it has, the people have to be so unaware of it as to allow it. And if we get somebody who might bring it up, well, that guy's got to go. And that's why no one man will ever solve the problem. And it's going to require a coalition not only of our allegedly public servants, but it requires the will of the people. Because the fact is that this country was based on the consent of the governed, and that is true, because there are always more of us than them. And you have to give them your consent either willingly because you agree with their agenda or passively with your silence. And until enough people stand up and say no, this kind of bullshit will keep happening. And that is the fundamental problem, is that people have got to wake up and start doing something about it. Interesting thing is that this speech that he gave was obviously prior to the great war to end all wars, you know,
right.
Wilson's, you know, let's make the world safe for democracy. And
the League of
Nations. All that kind of garbage. And then you can go to an interesting fact is that after Taft, the next Republican to hold office in the White House, was Warren Harding. And he came in 21, which was basically when we were kind of wrapping up the Depression of 1920, which, because the Fed was relatively new, was only 7 years old, didn't do so much. And that Depression, which could have been as bad as 29, lasted for 18 months, and we rolled right out of it. In 29, of course, it was a different story because Hoover basically built the New Deal, which Franklin Roosevelt pursued and magnified gloriously and extended that thing further and further and further. But the interesting thing is that this is before the Roaring Twenties. This is after World War One, and we got I think we got a clip from Harding, and it's kind of interesting to see how Republicans at the time viewed war and what you do after a war and how you handle basically money and foreign policy given this growing issue. This is kind of a long clip. It's 4 minutes and 21 seconds, but we'll play it and see if I get bored enough to cut it off early. But let's just take a listen to Warren G. Harding.
My countrymen, there isn't anything the matter with the world civilization except that humanity is viewing it through a vision impaired in a cataclysmal war. Poise has been disturbed in Nerves have been racked, and fever has rendered men irrational. Sometimes there have been drafts upon the dangerous cup of barbarity. Men have wandered far from safe paths, but the human procession still marches in the right direction. Here in the United States, we feel the reflex, rather than the hurting wound itself, but we still think straight, and we mean to act straight. We mean to hold firmly to all that was ours when war involved us, and seek the higher attainments which are the only compensations that so supreme a tragedy may give mankind. America's present need is not heroic, but healing. Not nostrums, but normalcy. Not revolution, but restoration. Not agitation, but adjustment. Not surgery, but serenity. Not the dramatic, but the dispassionate. Not experiment, but equipoise. Not subvergence in internationality, but sustainment in triumphant nationality. It's one thing to battle successfully against the world's domination by a military autocracy, because the infinite God never intended such a program. But it's quite another thing to revise human nature and suspend the fundamental laws of life and all of life's requirements. The world calls for peace. America demands peace, formal as well as actual. Means to...
Yeah, I couldn't deal with that bad audio, but I think we got the point. that speech was called Return to Normalcy, you know?
Yep.
And it's interesting to me that he said, not internationalism, but nationalism. Meaning that, you know, let's not get involved in crap like we did in World War II, no military autocracy, but, you know, let's focus on our own shores, which is very, very...
I wonder if that's why he died.
You know, I'm not going to necessarily tie all those threads, and I think people can draw their own conclusions, but what's fascinating to me is that if we take a look at what we just heard, right, which is going from 1896 to 1921, okay, Republican presidential speeches. Do they sound like George Bush? Do they sound like George H.W. Bush? Do they sound like Richard Nixon? I mean, or do they sound like some other guy who's a current, you know, Republican? Because to me,
yep,
these things don't, you know, and everybody's, you know, if we look at these principles, people might go, that doesn't sound like the Republicans anymore, you know, especially the way the left paints the Republicans as the party of war, right? I find that very, very interesting. And there is a Republican, though, that speaks like these guys, except that we paint him as a kook, don't we? You know, I mean, we don't say this is good stuff. We don't say, hey, you know, when Ron Paul speaks, he sounds like, you know, Harding and Coolidge and Taft. We say he's kooky, and we say, oh, I really like Ron Paul, except for his crappy foreign policy, right? But these guys sound more like Ron Paul than they sound like most other Republicans. Am I right?
Yep.
Pretty fascinating.
Well,
so it sounds like Ron Paul might be more traditional.
Harding was actually, I'd done quite a bit of research on Harding because of you know, the way he won at the convention. You know, came in with, I don't know, it was, yep, like 6.5%, and then of the delegates, and then it ended up winning. But what was interesting about Harding was he was a reformer. He went in, he reformed the civil servant system. He went on a national tour all over the country so that he could firsthand see this vast, you know, because it was still a new country, you know, especially
right,
the West, you know, and things like that. And he toured and met with people and got perspectives from people. What do you need? What are your issues? How can we serve you? It was actually, mm-hmm, I found him to be a very interesting person.
Yeah, I agree.
And he died early.
Yep. Yep. And you have to wonder if that's something that happened intentionally or if it was, you know, divine providence. You never know. You know, the fact is that, you know, that the hand of God, if you're a believer, is in everything, whether it's, you know, good or bad. He somehow had a hand in it. But here's the interesting thing, right? We hear these speeches. We understand these guys, and yeah, I think the way Harding came to the convention was pretty much how we expected Gingrich or Paul to get in this time. But then you listen to Ron Paul, and people go, oh, that's kooky. But let's listen to him now, and let's see if he sounds like these guys.
Why can't people understand that war always destroys wealth and liberty? Why is there so little concern for the executive order that gives the president authority to establish a kill list, including American citizens, of those targeted for assassination? Why is patriotism thought to be blind loyalty to the government and the politicians who run it, rather than loyalty to the principles of liberty and support for the people? Real patriotism is a willingness to challenge the government when it's wrong.
Challenge the government when it's wrong. I mean, you know, that sounds revolutionary, right? But that's pretty much how our founding fathers viewed it. He's echoing them, and he's talking about the dangers of war the way that these other were conservative Republican presidents did. So I think we got a lot to learn there.
Well, Harding was actually against the League of Nations. He was very, what in the hell, you know, country first, you know, America first campaign. Yeah, you know, he came back from Alaska and suddenly dropped dead. But it's he had a very interesting perspective. When I was reading on him, and I didn't spend as much time as I'd like to have studied him, but I kept getting this reflection of the way Newt thought. You know, instead of somebody at the top saying, you know, all these elites and aristocrats sitting around thinking what the rest of the world needs or deserves, he went out and said, let's go find out what people need and deserve or feel they need and deserve, and let's build our governance based on the will of the people. I mean, that's very much a Newt Gingrich mindset.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And I think that this is – I think by going – to our past and looking at when we had real conservative Republicans leading, we can see where this conservative message has been lost, and where when Newt hits it, he hits it so well and the establishment hates it. And when Ron Paul hits it, he hits it so well, the establishment hates it. And but this is what we used to look to. This is how we used to vote. These are the men we used to put in office. And now we shun them. Because it's not us who are voting. It's the television telling us how to vote. That's the problem. You know, that's the danger of not being involved politically as a duty. Okay, we all talk about our right to vote, right? Our right to vote. I have a right to my vote, and I can, you know, self-express myself and blah, blah. We're always talking about rights, but with rights come responsibilities and duties.
Yep.
And being politically involved, meaning being aware of what's going on and how things are supposed to work, is a duty. It's not a luxury. It's not a right you can abdicate. It's something that you have to do, because if we don't do it, we lose the country. And you can point fingers and blame the other side or blame somebody else or blame the politicians. But ultimately, it's our responsibility, because they have no power except that which we give them.
We sure have given them a lot, too.
Way too much. Way too much. And the fascinating thing to me is, you think that this is all, like, you know, weird stuff and what's going on. And, you know, Obama signs an executive order basically, you know, instituting martial law and be like, oh, executive orders are illegal. No, executive orders are a very useful tool, provided that they work within the executive department to put forward specific measures that realize or execute the laws passed by Congress. Not that the president can just write whatever the hell he wants, but that he's saying, okay, Congress passed this law, I've got to get these things done, this is the procedure we're doing it. And what a lot of people don't realize is that there are a lot of good executive orders. President Reagan in Order 12612 on federalism back in 87, where he was basically saying, by the authority here, I should do the first part of it. By the authority vested in me as president, by the Constitution and laws of the United States of America, and in order to restore the division of governmental responsibilities between the national government and the states that was intended by the framers of the Constitution, and to ensure that the principles of federalism established by the framers guide the executive departments and agencies in the formulation and implementation of policies. And he goes on to list very specific definitions. It's really something, you know, worth reading. Obviously, they don't, you know, follow a damn thing in it. But basically, you know, it enunciates that the states have not only rights but responsibilities to do certain things that the federal government is not supposed to intervene. He specifically speaks in there about the fact that the federal government should only be doing things that are within the enumerated powers.
You know what's funny about that? Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just a side note when you were talking about this executive order to reestablish that federalism clause. Mm-hmm. Guess who came in and negated it?
Guess who negated it?
Yeah. Who wrote an executive order to basically destroy Reagan's executive order?
Well, isn't that his successor?
Clinton.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess that's not a successor. Bush was a successor, but yeah, Clinton. Not
sorry,
to,
go
not
ahead.
To
I didn't mean that.
No, no, it's okay. Not that H.W. Bush was much of a yeah. I mean, it's funny though that Clinton did that, and then he went out and said the era of big government is over. What?
Yeah. Well,
how did you suddenly shift gears? Oh, that's right. The era of big government, you proclaimed it is over because Newt Gingrich told you no, and Clinton didn't do anything Newt wanted until what? Newt shut down the government. And the fascinating
thing.
Remember
the politics around that?
Oh yeah, it was
newspapers and
yeah, it was all you know. It was gar. It was you know the media was spinning. But look, the simple fact, and here's the interesting thing, because I was doing some research on this, and unfortunately I couldn't get as much done as I would like. But I went back through. You know, it's hard if you search for Newt Gingrich online, you get all sorts of bad crap. All right, they just beat the hell out of him. But I went to C-SPAN. Okay, and I searched their archives, and there is a plethora of stuff. And back then.
Yeah.
When the budget negotiations were going on, the contract with America, the government shutdown, all that stuff, Newt was doing like a press conference every other day. I mean, he was out there telling us exactly what was going on, exactly what happened, exactly what went on behind, quote, closed doors. He was keeping us posted. When was the last time you heard Boehner say anything, you know, actually relevant? Do we know what he and Obama
talked
about?
I've never heard Boehner speak more than 15 words in a row. Have you?
No. But it's because they feed him
Beautiful.
His lines. I was going to actually
of
get
the House. Speaker
yeah, I was actually going to play. I was going to play this clip later because I was going to build up to it with some Republicans past. But now that you brought it up, I just can't resist. I just cannot resist. This is very interesting, right? Because what's fascinating to me, and we've talked about this on the show, you've looked at on your site there, Chris, and the fact is that, you know, Boehner is giving Obama everything he wants. We've known this. We knew he was going to – we knew that the deal was already done before Romney lost, and they were going to work together, Romney and Boehner, to get it done, or Obama and Boehner fighting with each other to, quote, get the same thing done. And if you remember back in the debates when we would be like, Romney and Obama are the same. And then we'd listen to the debate, and they'd basically, well, I agree with the president. I agree with the governor. I agree with the president, you know. Well, we got the thing now with the speaker, right? So these are two people in the two most powerful offices agreeing. But we're led to believe that it's divided and that they are, you know, at each other's throats. Listen to this series of clips. Starts with Obama, and then it goes into
And I'm committed to working with members of both parties to cut our deficits and debt. But we can't simply cut our way to prosperity. But, as I've said before, we can't just cut our way to prosperity.
Now listen to Johnny, little Johnny boy. He's not crying here.
At some point, we're going to have to address the spending problem that we have. But we can't cut our way to prosperity. We need real economic growth.
Doesn't anyone notice this? I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
But we can't cut our way to prosperity.
Now, what did you hear there, Chris? Did you hear something similar?
That was pretty scary.
We can't cut our way to prosperity.
Hey,
wow.
And you know
and
who
they
else
both said it?
You know who else said that?
Huh?
What was the guy that stole the nomination? Sorry,
Romney. The Republican Romney. Nomination? Romney,
yeah,
right,
Romney.
That guy. Yeah.
He said,
yeah.
Remember way
uh-huh.
back, and people
uh-huh.
just
yep.
went, they rolled right over it. He
yep.
said, I'm not going to cut too much because mm. it'll hurt the economy. When has cutting wasteful government spending ever hurt the economy? It blew me away when I heard that, and they didn't even blip. Nobody even batted an eye, and I remember hearing
not.
That.
It's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, first of all, well, at some point we're going to have to address spending. What do you mean at some point? Dude, you're running a trillion-dollar deficit. I mean, remember something. When Newt shut down the government, right, when Newt shut down the government, the spending was at like $1.6 trillion, right? Now our deficit is almost the same as what we were spending not too many years ago, right? But we can't cut our way to prosperity. First of all, you have to ask yourself, who the hell ever asked the government to give us prosperity? I never asked them to give me prosperity. Just
well,
get the hell out of the way.
What
get out
is,
of the way.
What is an economy that is so fragile that you have to keep government agencies, jobs, fake jobs, you know, padded jobs, programs for the economy to be stable? That's pretty bad.
Of course. I mean, that's a whole corporatist agenda. Is they make you fear that if the government's not working, nothing's going to work. That's crap. And most things don't work because government makes them work. Most things work because, despite government. Most things work because small business owners and businesses are out there trying to serve people over the government red tape, over the regulations, over the tax burden. So, you know, the whole point, if you want prosperity, just get the government out of the way. And how do you do that? You cut spending. So little Johnny and Mr. Obama, you guys need to actually get out of the way until you need to cut spending. And the simple fact is, if you got trillion-dollar excess, you know, in spending, that's unsustainable. So a point,
it's
yeah,
more
some,
than that.
A point
it's
was 2 years, you know, years ago.
It's insane. Sorry. No, I was just saying it's insane because I remember the first 2 years of Obama in the economic down. Time mm-hmm. that everybody was touting all the increase in federal jobs, all the increase mm-hmm. in income levels and, you know, mm-hmm. wages and went from this to this to this. And it was almost like, I mean, I believe they did it on purpose to make it such a huge chunk of the economy that oh, they yeah. could get to a point where they could actually say we can't afford to cut it because they need that income and that tax, even though it's being stolen from some of the, you know, it's that rob Peter to pay Paul kind of.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And look, here's the crazy thing. These are Republicans saying this crap. Romney, Boehner, Cantor, even Ryan to some degree. I mean, you know, he's talking about cutting some ridiculous small number that seems huge and balancing the budget like by, you know, 2054 or something ridiculous like that. We're not going to make it that long. So, you know, these are allegedly Republicans, and of course they speak conservative, and then they run around doing this kind of stuff. And even their conservative speak is so weak now. Let's go back to the 20s. Let's go to a guy that he didn't speak all that much because, you know, he was pretty soft-spoken. He just was direct. He said what he wanted to do, and then he did it. And so he got the nickname Silent Cal. That's President Coolidge.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, he's one of my favorite presidents, and we're going to listen mm-hmm. to him talking about Republican principles. Just listen to this.
I believe in the American Constitution. I favor the American system of individual enterprise, and I am opposed to any general extension of government ownership and control. I believe not only in advocating economy and public expenditure, but in its practical application and actual accomplishment. I believe in a reduction and reform of taxation, and shall continue my efforts in that direction. I am in favor of protection. I believe in the permanent court and further limitation of armaments. I am opposed to aggressive war. I shall avoid involving ourselves in the political controversies of Europe, but I shall do what I can to encourage American citizens and resources to assist in restoring Europe with the sympathetic support of our government. I want agriculture and industry on a sound basis of prosperity and equality. I shall continue to strive for the economic, moral, and spiritual welfare of my country. The laws of the land are being and will continue to be enforced.
Pretty amazing.
Wow.
Huh? Now, that was back in the 1920s, because I think he was president from 23 to 29. But oddly enough, there is strong indication that that speech was written by Ron Paul.
Yeah, I was going to say it sounded like Ron Paul.
Yeah, and that's a traditional conservative Republican, Calvin Coolidge. You know, he talked about a lot of stuff in there, not aggressive war, armaments. He talked about government being out of the way. I mean, that's what the Republican Party is supposed to be, not only in rhetoric, not only speak that way, but actually do it. And Cal did, because the 20s, you know, the roaring 20s, we saw booming economy. Now, granted, a lot of that was, you know, easy money by the Federal Reserve. You know, they started screwing things up back then. But it was also a period of time where American ingenuity and know-how created so many, I mean, before the, quote, you know, computer and technology revolution, created pretty much every single thing that we consider a modern necessity was created and invented by Americans and not built by Chinese. It was made, developed by Americans, built by Americans, manufactured by Americans, and distributed by Americans, and it changed the world.
And the natural resources came out of whose soil?
Canada?
Yeah. You know what's funny about Coolidge, I get a kick out of him, is as conservative as he is, guess where he came from?
Where Coolidge came from?
Yeah.
Vermont, right?
Massachusetts.
Yeah, same thing, Vermont.
He climbed up the ladder in Massachusetts state politics. So we have a true conservative, if not Ron Paul, libertarian conservative, out of Massachusetts, and we have severely conservative Mitt Romney out of Massachusetts. I mean, isn't that just an oxymoron?
Well, it is, but I mean, you're talking about a pretty significant period of time past. Because remember something back in
what the hell happened?
You know,
to Massachusetts?
Coolidge wasn't elected the first time, right? He became president, and then
when Harding died.
And then when he was running in 24, okay, the Democrats ran against him. They ran Davis. And Davis is the last authentically conservative Democrat to run for the White House. And it was because they played with progressivism, right? You know, the progressives came in and they tried to, in both parties, right? Roosevelt and, you know, Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. And they, you know, what they brought us was the Fed, inflation, war, and everybody was like, you know what? F that, you know, we don't want to play that game. So in 24, the Democrats, and he was not the chosen one. I think they had something like 113 ballots at their convention, and Davis won.
Wow.
And they ran him against Coolidge. Now, Davis lost, not because people didn't like him, and not because he wasn't a good guy, not because he wasn't conservative, which at the time, Democrats were conservative. But he lost because he on policy, he was almost identical to Coolidge.
Right.
They were both very conservative,
why,
very good policies. The economy was good.
Replace,
people were like,
why replace the guy that's in power? Yeah.
Exactly.
Isn't that Romney Obama issue?
Exactly. Same friggin' problem. This time they were both progressives, but it was like, okay, well, if we're going to go down this progressive nightmare, might as well go with, you know, the guy we know rather than this guy that, you know, no one can quite, he has no core. We can't put our finger on him. And that's, you know, that's, in my opinion, the dominant reason. He lost. Let's get through a couple more of these clips so that we can round out the first hour and then maybe tear into this Newt memo. But in regards to the principles that he just highlighted there, we had another conservative several years later highlighted in a very powerful speech. This is in 64. I'm only going to get us the first 3 minutes, but I strongly suggest that we all listen carefully to the words of this great man. This is called The Time for Choosing.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you and good evening. The sponsor has been identified, but unlike most television programs, the performer hasn't been provided with a script. As a matter of fact, I have been permitted to choose my own words and discuss my own ideas regarding the choice that we face in the next few weeks. I have spent most of my life as a Democrat. I recently have seen fit to follow another course. I believe that the issues confronting us cross party lines. Now, one side in this campaign has been telling us that the issues of this election are the maintenance of peace and prosperity. The line has been used, we've never had it so good. But I have an uncomfortable feeling that this prosperity isn't something on which we can base our hopes for the future. No nation in history has ever survived a tax burden that reached a third of its national income. Today, 37 cents out of every dollar earned in this country is the tax collector's share. And yet our government continues to spend $17 million a day more than the government takes in. We haven't balanced our budget 28 out of the last 34 years. We've raised our debt limit three times in the last 12 months. And now our national debt is 1.5 times bigger than all the combined debts of all the nations of the world. We have $15 billion in gold in our treasury. We don't own an ounce. Foreign dollar claims are $27.3 billion. And we've just had announced that the dollar of 1939 will now purchase 45 cents in its total value.
I wish.
As for the peace that we would preserve, I wonder who among us would like to approach the wife or mother whose husband or son has died in South Vietnam and ask them if they think this is a peace that should be maintained indefinitely. Do they mean peace, or do they mean we just want to be left in peace? There can be no real peace while one American is dying someplace in the world for the rest of us. We're at war with the most dangerous enemy that has ever faced mankind in his long climb from the swamp to the stars. And it's been said if we lose that war, and in so doing lose this way of freedom of ours, history will record with the greatest astonishment that those who had the most to lose did the least to prevent its happening. Well, I think it's time we ask ourselves if we still know the freedoms that were intended for us by the Founding Fathers. Not too long ago, two friends of mine were talking to a Cuban refugee, a businessman who had escaped from Castro. And in the midst of his story, one of my friends turned to the other and said, "We don't know how lucky we are." And the Cuban stopped and said, "How lucky you are. I had some place to escape to." And in that sentence, he told us the entire story. If we lose freedom here, there's no place to escape to. This is the last stand on earth.
Powerful, huh?
Sad. That's the thing that came to my mind, not to play word games, but it was just sad that people have lost the importance of what he just said. Because I really believe that people think, a large majority of people think, that the future of America is some, you know, they've been brainwashed into some socialistic paradigm, you know, that's my future versus the concept of pure freedom, you know, that our founding fathers espoused too. Also, and I'll add this because I know you have things to say, but Harding was the first one that used the term founding fathers.
Yeah. Yeah, well, because before that, you know, it was not that far back in history, so it was more like, you know, when we look back at Reagan, as you move through history, things have a perspective. And the problem with not taking a look at the ghosts of the past to see where we are in the present and know where we're going is small little incremental veering off course over a vast distance, you're way off course. But if you look back at the past and you keep looking back at it and look at where you are, you can correct those minor tangential, you know, areas where you're off course, and over time you won't be that far from the mark. But we don't. And I mean, you know, Reagan was a Democrat and a New Deal Democrat, right? And then he realized, wow, this crap doesn't work. I mean, they promised us all this good stuff and it didn't work. This is awful. And so, like he said, you know, I didn't leave the Democrat Party; they left me. But that was in 64, right, for Goldwater. And then it wasn't until 1980 that Reagan was able to win. And even then, I mean, it wasn't a sure thing. You know, Bush was their guy. You know, Mr. Voodoo Economics, he was their guy. It wasn't Reagan. He was their Mitt Romney to, you know, Reagan, who was Gingrich Paul. And but he won, and they were surprised. But listen to what he said as president. Now, this is, you know, when he was campaigning for Goldwater. Now, listen to this. This is Reagan as president on the budget.
"We must cut out more non-essential government spending and root out more waste, and we will continue our efforts to reduce the number of employees in the federal workforce by 75,000. The budget plan I submit to you on February 8th will realize major savings by dismantling the Departments of Energy and Education and by eliminating ineffective subsidies for business.
Well, listen to that.
That was pretty short-lived, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, they packed his administration with neocons and rhinos and, you know, drowned out the message. But, you know, it's pretty amazing. But look at how far we've gotten because, you know, Bush called, you know, H.W. called Reagan's economics voodoo economics, right? And then he got in. He ran as a Reaganite and then got in and did all sorts of rhino bullshit. And his son, right, when everything hit the fan, this is what he said as a, quote, compassionate conservative Republican, right? This is what he said.
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. What the hell is that? I mean, look, as a logical statement, that makes no sense. As a Republican statement, that makes no sense. As a conservative statement, it's just insane. But that's what we
You know how insane that is? That's the same thing as saying we can't cut government because it'll hurt the economy.
How is that going to hurt the economy?
That's the insanity of it.
Well, it is insanity. It's absolutely insanity. And, you know, grow a pair and quit caving on this stuff and you know, this Keynesian BS. And I know that, you know, people attribute that to, you know, the Republicans going off the Keynesian cliff, they attribute that to Richard Nixon, which, you know, I think to some degree is somewhat true. But people think that he says we're all Keynesians now, which is actually not true. That's Milton Friedman said that, referring to Richard Nixon. And he was kind of mimicking a statement that was made by a socialist. I can't remember when, but I think it might have been in the 20s, where it was, you know, we're all socialists now, which was brought back
right.
into fashion by Newsweek as soon as Obama got elected the first time. But what Nixon actually said, right, he says, I am now a Keynesian in economics. Well, yeah, because you got off the gold standard internationally. You had to become a Keynesian because that's the only option is paper inflation. So, you know, in a sense, that's where the Republican Party really went wrong on economics, and we've been, you know, in terrible shape ever since, other than Reagan and Gingrich. You know, they brought some sense into the equation. And if you think this is insane, well, you know, who is likely to be the Republican to call the Republicans out on their insanity?
Yeah.
Who? Who's likely to do it?
No.
There's only two of them that I know of. Newt Gingrich
well,
or
yeah.
Ron Paul. There are only two Republicans
yeah.
that call him out on, you know?
Exactly.
And,
I thought you were asking me a trick question.
Yeah, it is a trick question. It's always a trick question when you're asking if the Republicans are conservative these days.
Right.
But one thing, in addition to the Time for Choosing speech by Reagan that we should all listen to again, listen to Ron Paul's farewell speech. It is
yeah.
absolutely awesome. I've got a condensed version here that we'll listen to real quick as we round out the first hour.
We must reject the notion of prior restraint in economic activity just as we do in the area of free speech and religious liberty. Claiming there is a choice of a little tyranny is like describing pregnancy as a touch of pregnancy. It is a myth to believe that a mixture of free markets and government central economic planning is a worthy compromise. The wealth we see today is based on debt and a foolish willingness on the part of foreigners to take our dollars for goods and services. Then they loan them back to us to perpetuate our debt system. It's amazing that it has worked for this long, but the impasse in Washington in solving our problems indicate that many are starting to understand the seriousness of this worldwide debt crisis and the dangers we face. The problem we have faced over the years has been that economic interventionists are swayed by envy, whereas social interventionists are swayed by intolerance or of habits and lifestyles. The misunderstanding that tolerance is an endorsement of certain activity motivates many to legislate moral standards, which should only be set by individuals making their own choices. Both sides use force to deal with these misplaced emotions. Both are authoritarians. Neither endorses voluntarism. Both views ought to be rejected. I have come to one firm conviction after these many years of trying to figure out the plain truth of things. The best chance for achieving peace and prosperity for the maximum number of people worldwide is to pursue the cause of liberty. If you find this to be a worthwhile message, spread it throughout the land. And I yield back the balance of my time.
There you have it. Liberty, right? But he sounds a lot more like those old-time Republicans than the Nixon, Ford, Bush, Boehner, Cantor Republicans of today.
You know,
I
get this flash of revelation of the need to skip the 20th century Republicans and go back, you know what I mean, to these early days, and educate people on people who actually cared about moving the country forward. Because, you know, a lot of these people, the ghosts of presidents past, you know, as you go through those old speeches and you look at that era, people don't realize, but we were still very frontierish in a lot of ways. We were still, you know, establishing ourselves as a nation, and we were also coming out of the Industrial Revolution. We were living that prosperity and that explosion of electricity, automobiles, you know, all those things, and including, you know, reaching out into the largest war that had ever been fought. But, yep, you know, that whole dynamics of that time was very, you know, you talk about the Roaring Twenties. You know, mm-hmm, that came out of the explosion of mass manufacturing, you know, Ford and his automobile and all those dynamics that occurred at that point in time. It was a very modern era. I mean, we were still driving dirt roads across this country.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. And I think that, I mean, if we look back at our history and we see that, you know, we're the most powerful, prosperous nation in the history of humankind, we just have to understand a couple of things. In recent times, I'd say since the Industrial Revolution and most of the 20th century, that occurred despite government, not because of it. And you have to ask yourself, without the government intervention and regulations, without the Federal Reserve, how much more could we have done, and how many more of the 7 billion people on this planet would be better off today? And, you know, you'll never know. You can always play the what-if game. You'll never know. But the fact is that ontologically you could argue that, you know, based on principles, things would be considerably better. And, of course, now we're looking that they're getting considerably worse. And I think that that's something that we really need to focus on. All right, call-in number, folks, is 646-649-1013. If you'd like to talk about these clips, ghosts of Republican presidents past, present, and future, and take a look at where we're going, or if you just want to give a Christmas shout-out, please call in, 646-649-1013. Chris, before we get into this Newt article, if we ever even make it, maybe it'll be another show. since we're talking about Newt, I just wanted to, you know, so we're looking forward, right? So, you know, we've been playing these clips of the past, and then we played, well, you know, we're going to play it again just because it's a really good clip. This is the extent of the negotiations that we are getting from John Boehner, allegedly on the conservative side, now. And we really have to understand that this guy's the problem. And he's up for re-election January 3rd. I know Christmas holidays are here, and there's a lot of things going on. I mean, you know, the Christmas season really begins tomorrow night and lasts at least through January 6th, you know, the 12 days of Christmas and the three kings coming from the Orient to pay homage to the King of Kings. But, you know, January 3rd isn't that far away, and we've got to put pressure on these guys to get rid of Boehner, you know, fire Boehner. And they're starting to realize that this is happening, and there's going to be a fight because the rhinos are going to struggle. Your representatives are home now. Hammer them, right? Obviously not tomorrow night and not on, you know, Tuesday. That's a day to celebrate the birth of the Lord. But as soon as that's over, start hammering, because we've got to let them know that if they reelect this guy, they're all in big trouble. And actually, we're in big trouble if we allow it, because the simple fact is this is the extent of his negotiations. That's the wrong clip. I did not, although it's accurate. I meant to play this one again. Here we go. Listen to this. Starts with Obama again, remember.
and I'm committed to working with members of both parties to cut our deficits and debt. But we can't simply cut our way to prosperity.
But, as I've said before, we can't just cut our way to prosperity.
And then here comes little Johnny boy crying and
saying
the same thing.
At some point, we're
going
to have to address the spending problem that we have. But we can't cut our way to prosperity. We need real economic growth.
I'm taking crazy pills, man.
I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
Crazy pills.
But we can't
that's
cut
the conservative?
Our way to prosperity.
Goodness gracious. I mean, it's frightening, right? And then, you know, someone who we know cut. Someone who we know was giving continuous conferences, continuous press conferences, continuous talks, and actually had to fight not only with a liberal Democrat president who was powerful and popular. He had to fight with rhinos in the Senate majority. So when Boehner says, well, you know, Harry Reid, blah, blah, blah. I mean, honestly, when Gingrich was speaker, was Bob Dole really that different than Harry Reid? I don't think so. And this is what Newt recently had to say about this stuff.
I'm frankly not at all encouraged by what I see and a little bit worried by it. I think, first of all, let me lay my cards on the table. I think that no deal is better than a bad deal. I think going off this cliff is less dangerous than letting things build up for a year or 2 years to have an even bigger cliff. I think that the president clearly has staked out a position of non-seriousness, and I think that it's very difficult for the House Republicans right now to find any practical way to get his attention. So he just won an election. He's feeling very good about himself. He is posturing brilliantly. He's putting the Republicans in a corner. They need to relax. They don't have an election until November of 2014. They need to say, look, you want to negotiate seriously, we'll sit down and talk. You don't want to negotiate seriously, the country will survive going off this cliff. It's largely a factor in terms of American history that people will not look back on as a giant tragedy. We need to have serious effort to get this country reorganized, and I see no sign that the political system today is at all prepared for that kind of serious thinking.
God, that pisses me off.
Yeah?
Yeah, you know, because that guy could be running things right now and implementing his whole detailed strategy. Remember Newt sitting down and goes, on day one, the first 30 days, this is what we'll do. This is how we will move. This is how we will make things. This is how we will work together.
We're pissing it away by
now. He's brilliant to everybody, and everybody wants to know what he thinks. He's the only guy. I'll get on a roll, Ron Paul's a great guy, but Ron Paul does not have the detailed strategy across the board. He has his strengths, and they're a handful. Newt sees every component of every facet, you know, from economics to foreign policy to, you know, whatever. It's just frustrating some days.
Well, it's true. Look, the simple fact is Ron Paul is 100% right in principle, and Newt and he are on the same page on maybe 80%. You know, there's a significant difference in the other 20%. But you know what? That's Big Tent Republican Party. You work those things out. But the simple fact is that Newt has the record of being effective, of getting things done. And, you know, this is where you got to think tactically and strategically. You know, we keep talking about 2016 because we just got out of 2012, so we're looking at the president. Well, you know, the president is an important job, okay, especially when it comes to military foreign interventionism, especially now that they've got, you know, kill lists and indefinite detention.
Yeah, I was going to say, you got to keep the drones flying. Got to keep the drones employed.
But when it comes to the money, which eventually affects the foreign policy, there is nobody more powerful than the Speaker of the House. So you got to shit-can Boehner on the 23rd. There are a number of other people who would make a better choice. I'm even willing to, even though I think she lied and mistreated Newt and was really disrespectful of someone who supported her in the past in the primaries, Michelle Bachmann has indicated that she wants to run against Boehner, and frankly, I think she'd do a much better job, and I think she's got way more balls than he does. But we can still make Newt Gingrich Speaker of the House. But the real pressure has to be get rid of Boehner And don't replace him with Cantor because it's his turn, or McCarthy, or Ryan, or one of those other rhino pussies running around screaming like, you
know. Game over, man. It's game over.
You know, that's what those guys are doing. Or you know, they go talk to Obama, and he's so impressive, they come running
back. This can't be happening, man. This isn't happening.
You know, come on. You know, you need somebody with spine. So remove Boehner. And frankly, look, it's Christmas. It's a time of hope. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit now in the second hour. We're going to go into a little more positive message. But I want you to keep in mind something, that there are two things that we focus on following the celebration of Christmas, which is truly the celebration of eternity breaking in time, which is a profound event. But the Feast of St. Stephen is on the 26th. St. Stephen was the first Christian martyr post-resurrection who was killed for his faith. And, you know, you got to internalize that, because the fact is that do we have to die for what we believe in? Hopefully not. And we still have plenty of tools at our disposal to prevent that kind of thing from happening. But if you don't show up with the zeal to be prepared to die for what you believe, you're showing up half-loaded and really convicted. You're not all in, okay? And you got to look back to the real martyrs of the inheritance that we have. You know, our founding fathers were some of the wealthiest men in the British colonies. They had a lot of material resources to lose. They had prestige and position to lose. You know, they had a lot.
A lot of it.
And they did lose a lot of it. And, of course, their decision at the time was treasonous, and the punishment for it was hanging and death. That's what they risked. And they actually said it. They said, we pledge our lives. That means bleeding for their country. Well, not even their country at the time, because the country had just been made by their declaration when they seceded from Great Britain. And by the way, it's called the Declaration of Independence, not the Petition for Independence. They didn't ask King George for permission. They just told him, hey, dude, this is our country. F off. Okay? That's how you do it. These men had balls. They pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. Okay? If you're not prepared to go to that length, you have already lost. There are tools at your disposal, but it takes a critical mass, a committed mass, to get there. And Christmas is a good time to reflect on these things, because as we celebrate the birth of Jesus Christ, keep in mind that the wood of the manger that he was born in always had the shadow of the wood of his cross over it, because God sent his only begotten Son into this world on Christmas in order for us to crucify him on Good Friday so that he would rise on Easter Sunday. Okay, so it's a good time to think about that, because if it's important, then you're willing to lay your life down on it, up for it. If you're not willing to die for it, it's not important to you, in which case accept your quiet slavery and quit bitching, because you've accepted it and that's what you want. So stand up, you know. Let's make this really happen. We've got tools at our disposal. More people agree with us than not. I mean, I bump into people all the time that think like we do, but people are afraid to say it. Don't be afraid to say it. Get up and do it. Grab other people and get them on board. Get them to join you also. Okay? So, you know, it's clearly an important thing to do, and Christmas is a great time to reflect on it. And then get busy on the 26th, and let's make sure we fire Boehner. Chris, we've got a couple of callers on the line. The first one is actually got to be out your way, because it's the same area.
Yeah, it's my son.
So you are live with Tex, or not Tex, Tex not here, Rex and Trog.
This is Lucas. I'm Trog's eldest child.
So you're a mini Trog.
Mini Trog, yeah.
What's on your mind,
member? Well, I wanted to do a quick question before we dive into this nude article, because that's a fantastic article, and I don't want to take away from the importance of that during this next hour. But this whole fiscal cliff, a scary word and something we have to avoid. What is it? I have yet to find anything out there that defines what it is. What are the consequences if we don't, you know, raise taxes and implement all these other socialist agendas, which seems to be the kind of stuff Republicans tend to compromise on, regardless of the control that they have, to, you know, make it so bad that we have to do this so we can avoid it instead of just fixing the issues, you know.
Well, I think it's kind of two-sided. Yeah, it's a two-sided thing, I think. Number one, I mean, raising taxes at all is really stupid idea when you've got an anemic economy and technically a recession that hasn't ended. But, you know, the simple fact is taxes are going up anyway because the taxes embedded in the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act are going to hit January 1st,
yep,
with or without a fiscal cliff. So we're getting mm-hmm. screwed there. And, you know, frankly, these tax increases, as much as they suck and as much as I'm against them, I mean, frankly, I think the income tax should be zero. So whether it's 35% for the top earners or 39.6%, I mean, it's almost a rhetorical difference. But the spending cuts are not big enough to really make a difference, but at least be cuts. They'd be more cuts than we've seen. So in my opinion, I mean, and like Newt said, we should fall off this cliff. Because let's face it, it would just make the Democrats look absolutely terrible. It would make Boehner look terrible, which is great because we want to get rid of him. And then maybe the 113th Congress can go back and fix things. But, I mean, I don't think it would be that bad. It really wouldn't be that bad. The only problem, of course, is with the extra taxes and even with these cuts, they still won't send any money towards the debt. And it doesn't. And even these cuts don't close a $1 trillion deficit. They just don't.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah,
I mean, it's not going to fix anything. But it would at least be a step in the right direction. But I mean, from a political standpoint, Newt's 100% right. I don't know why the Republicans are freaking out over this. Man, granted, to some degree, they're the ones that built the stupid thing back in 01 and 03.
Yep.
But at this point, you know, let Obama own it. Let Harry Reid own it. Let them fail on it. I mean, you know, like he said, they got till 2014. If you let the Democrats fall on their face and you get a real good 113th Congress with a speaker with some balls, I think it would be fantastic.
You know, there's two people, Rex, that have talked about what you just said, and that is Newt and Dr. Rand Paul are the
yep.
only two people that have said, let them own it. And
yep.
of course, you and I have said it too, because I've said it before, you know, mm-hmm. that the greatest gift that we have with Obama getting reelected is that it's now his problem and the
yep.
economy. And we've talked about this economically, but the economy, is there's another correction coming anyway, regardless of, even if they cut $1 trillion this right now, there's still another correction coming because you got QE1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 18, 20. You know, you've got all these components of printed money and borrowed money from China, a world economy going psycho, the Fed lending, I don't know, have we ever figured it out, $13, $14 trillion to Europe, which is crumbling. And there's all these dynamics, and then the whole China dollar deal. So there's a lot of things at play that are going to come to bear. There's no way that some of this is not going to occur in the next 2, 3, 4 years. And so Obama's going to own it. The Republicans need to back off and focus on 2014 and the things that will make them win, which in reality, what's winning, and of course this, you'll get into this in the Newt article, but what's winning is conservatism on the state level. That's what's winning, not the federal
yep.
level, because they're a bunch of dips up there. I am embarrassed to even equate these people with anything I've ever been involved in this party. These people are disgusting, you know, what
well,
they've done to our federal government.
What Boehner and the House is about to do in the near future, when all these corrections do start coming down the pipeline, you have Obama and the other Democrats up there saying, well, this is what the Republicans gave us to work with. It's their fault. You know, that narrative has been used countless of times.
Oh, yeah.
I've only been able to vote 3 times in my lifetime. And I already recognize it. I'm wondering what's wrong with your guys' generation.
So you're absolutely right, and the thing is that the Democrats always have the high ground, so to speak, in the conflict. Okay, it's because the media is overwhelmingly for them. That's right. And Newt speaks about that, and I got to be very honest with you. This article is so in depth that I mean, there is just no way that we're going to be able to get through it in the next 35 minutes. So I'm not sure how much of it will address. Maybe we can hit some of the high points if you guys have read it. What you'd like to bring up, but I have a feeling that we'll make this next week's show. because it is powerful. And if you haven't read it, it's, I put it in chat. It's on the Tex and Rex page. So if you know, go to Facebook, go to the Tex and Rex show, and like our page, you'll get feeds of updates of the show. And also, I post the articles and videos and stuff that we use on the show page. And also, if you're in Blog Talk Radio or in Blog Talk Radio chat, just click follow show right under the icon, and you'll also get notifications in your Blog Talk Radio and associated email. But look, the simple fact is the Democrats control the high ground in the media. When I say the Democrats, I'm talking about both those in the Democratic Party and Democrats like Karl Rove and John Boehner who are in the Republican Party. They control the media messaging, and either they fail on purpose or just they were chosen to fail like Mitt Romney, or they're overwhelmed by the message. However, Gingrich managed to handle the messaging. Like I said, if you go to C-SPAN and just look up Newt Gingrich's C-SPAN clips, there's like every couple of days in 95 and 96, he was out there speaking the language, and he put Clinton, who was fantastic at messaging. I mean, you can say that in the last 40 years we've had two presidents that were truly good communicators at getting their word out, Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton. And Newt managed to shut Clinton down with the proper messaging. And I think it's pretty key to the understanding of how the real Republican Party, real conservative Republican Party, which embraces the authentic Tea Party, the Ron Paul Revolution, libertarian-leaning, you know, fiscal conservatives, as well as Christian conservatives and people who are, national security conservatives who are not necessarily neocons, Newt was able to push that kind of powerful messaging out there, and he mentioned that as one of the strategies used before negotiations. In fact, in the article he wrote that we reviewed, I think it was two shows ago, he talked about negotiations being the least important, the least effective, and the last thing that you do after all the other stuff, appropriations being number one and legislation being, I think, number two, as well as messaging, which is precisely where Boehner didn't go. He went to his weakest card, and he played it. So either Boehner is completely incompetent, or he's intentionally trying to fail.
Yeah.
And either way, he's got to go. He's got to go.
Well,
gentlemen, we are joined on the line. I'll take it to you, Chris, in a second, but I just want to introduce another caller to the conversation. We have Robert Jetter of Bard's Logic Political Talk on the line. Hey, Robert, Merry Christmas.
Thank you very much, Rex, for letting me on. And, yes, I called in. Merry Christmas to everyone on the line and to all the listeners. Thank you.
All right, Chris, why don't you make your point, and then we'll let's see what's on Robert's mind.
One of the things that I have said for years, and of course you heard my son say it because he's heard me screaming at the every time a Republican gets on TV way before the primary, is messaging. And Newt was a master at identifying what the American people were interested in, at coalescing around the people, which really, if you want to take that in terms of modern terminology, is finding out what the people in the individual states want, not what the cronies in the federal game or the conventions or the RNC, but finding out what people is important to people. Then he was good at coalescing that into a strategy and getting people behind it. Then when he was in the process of the battle or the negotiations, as you say, he was able to use that power of messaging and communication and educating and keeping people updated on the things that were important to them, which was also his strategy. And you know what's amazing about this is, you know who learned from Newt Gingrich? It wasn't the frickin' Republicans. It was the Democrats that learned from Newt Gingrich, because he set C-SPAN in motion, brought him into the chambers, did all this stuff that he did this grassroots concept across the country, educated up the next generation of Republican leaders, and he created a sweeping win, and then he got things done against a Democratic president, a very liberal one at that. He got things done because he had the will of the people behind him, and he made sure he was in the spotlight continually communicating to people. Now, who does that, Republicans or Democrats? Republicans, every time they get on in front of a camera, they make fools of themselves. And whether the Democrats lie or not, they're always touching the heartstrings. They're always talking straight to the
to the issues at hand, and they get people on their side whether they're lying or not, because they message well, and that, and they learned that from Newt. Unfortunately, the flippin' Republicans never learned it, or they're just so offended by Newt's success, and they can't stand him because he's so brilliant that anything he says, they just have to do the opposite, almost like a wayward child. I don't know what's wrong with the Republicans, honestly.
Well, I mean, it's a question. I don't know that they didn't learn from Newt. I think that they learned that they need to shut Newt up because he actually stops the spending. You know, look, the thing is that when the corruption is so entrenched because you got a loose money system and you've got corporatist control of government, basically, is these guys don't want to upset their masters. They don't want to stop the money from flowing. So they're going to do all these ridiculous things. And the fact is, I can't tell you how many times. Look, I never registered as a Republican, and you can lay that blame squarely on George H.W. Bush's shoulders, because, you know, I was so excited about being a Republican when Reagan was president. He actually, you know, came to my high school and gave a great speech. I was very excited about this, but I wasn't old enough to vote. And then, you know, Bush was reelected running on a Reagan platform, and then he turned out to not be. And so I was like, you know what? Yeah, screw these people. They're liars. They're not. This isn't the party of Reagan. This is the party of, you know, I don't know what.
Rockefeller.
But the simple fact is we always have to understand, you know, I get really irritated when I speak about conservative things to people and I point out conservative things, and then they come attack me by attacking Republicans like George Bush and Karl Rove. I'm like, dude, I don't like those guys, and I'm not a Republican. I would like to be a Republican. I would be happy to go become a Republican if I could be certain that they were going to be conservatives. I don't have that assurance. I think it can happen, but it hasn't happened yet. And until these people really embrace the future of the party, this is kind of where we were going with the show, and let's be honest, we're running out of time, and we haven't discussed this article, so I apologize. Read the article. We'll make it next week's show. And maybe, you know, Robert, if you've got an opening, you can start discussing it on your show, too.
This is a several-day article.
We could do 20, 30 hours on this thing. Newt himself says that this is part of a 6-month study. So, I mean, there's going to be stuff coming out about this, and it's very good. I suggest everybody to check it out. But the simple fact is, where do we go in the future? Well, the future is real simple. And once we get into this thing with Newt, we'll even see it. And he points it out. If you want a future for the GOP, there's two things. You have to win, right? But you don't just win to win, because you can manipulate and lie and win, but then no one really won anything, because then you're not going to put forward the agenda on which you want. But if they want to win, then they have to do what the people want. And what the people have shown them that they want, you know, now they can talk all day long about, we didn't appeal to women, we didn't appeal to Latinos, we didn't appeal to Asian Americans, blah, 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 blah. Look, Ron Paul did. Ron Paul did.
Yeah.
Okay? And his movement is coming into your party.
Can I read you a quote? I'm sorry. Can I read you a quote?
Yeah, please. Go.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you. But the Democrats, this is from Newt, the Democrats have been building a national machine while Republicans have been running campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
He
exactly.
Nailed it right there.
What Newt was successful in when he was Speaker of the House is to get across conservative, ideas and get conservatism passed while having, you know, Clinton in office. So he didn't give up his conservative principles in order to, play the way Boehner has been playing with, Obama.
Exactly, right.
I mean, the whole reach across the aisle, he wasn't giving up his conservative principles in order to do that.
Right, because he made Clinton reach across the aisle. John Boehner's playing reach around with Obama.
Grab ass.
Look, the simple fact is when Newt said that they're running a machine and we're running campaigns, that's absolutely true. It's this consultant model of losers like Karl Rove who come up with these stupid negative points to show how bad the Democrats are so that people will just by default vote for the lesser evil instead of putting forward a positive message of, look, this is why we're good. This is why, hey, it doesn't matter if you're a woman or a Latino or an Asian American or gay or an old white dude. These principles appeal to you because it gives you more autonomy. It allows you to keep more of your money. It creates a stable, growing economy and gives you opportunities to live the life that you want. That's a message that people want. And Ron Paul showed the way to that, and Newt Gingrich is telling you how to get things done. with the opposition. He showed us how you move the opposition to your side of the table, and Ron Paul's giving us where the future of the party is going. So as we visited Harding and McKinley and Coolidge, and we've looked at Republicans past, and you're looking at Republicans present who are basically, you know, abdicated their conservative credentials in order to become, you know, Washington insiders. If you want Republican future that's authentically conservative, you have to embrace the Ron Paul revolution. You have to embrace the principles that inspired people to go and protest as the Tea Party. And then you have to have an effective way of defeating the opposition by pointing out how terrible their ideas are, where they have failed historically, and showing how the conservative message is the message of liberty and stable values in the economy so that people can trade appropriately. And that is how you embrace everybody, because that is not a identity-specific personal issue. You know, this identity politics is garbage, because the fact is that if you really want to be a strong conservative political party, you have to appeal to Americans on American values and quit dividing people. This is a tool of the left, and these rhinos are Alinskyites, and they try to use the same tool, but guess what? The libs have been doing it since the 60s. They're much better at it than you are, you losers. So why don't you do what Gingrich did? Why don't you go where Ron Paul is sending you and be honest about it?
Here's an important point, and I this is just something that I feel and believe is one of the most important things that needs to be done with the Republican Party, and that is an honest assessment and a little bit of buy-in to the Bush era and what it did to this country. Because the mistake you make is when you unflinchingly, you know, defend Bush 100% of the way, when there is no doubt that his policies and his endless wars and things that he did, you know, handed us a very bad situation. Obama inherited that. Even though, yeah, you could argue, you know, Democrats were part of the last couple of years and blah, 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 and Bush sure needed his trillions of dollars to keep his wars going. Why? You know what I mean? And nobody on our side is willing to get honest about that. And as long as we don't get honest about it, people will not trust Republicans.
Well, here's the problem. The problem is you you plant the flag and you join the team, right? And when the team screws up, you've got to defend the team. You don't have to defend the team. Defend the principles. Because players on this team, right, they're offsides. They're offsides. Don't defend them. I mean,
there's very little that he did that has anything to do with conservatism.
Look, I get liberals and others attack me all the time when I'm talking about something. They say, well, George Bush, blah, 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 blah. I say, I'm not defending Bush. I mean, how do you defend this?
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
I mean, that's all you got to say right there. And then throw him away and don't feel like that destroys conservatism. There's nothing conservative about what he said. So, you know, you don't have to defend George Bush in order to defend conservatism, because he wasn't. It's just pretty straightforward, you know. So the issue is not, the Republican Party. The issue is conservative principles. Now, that happens to have a home in the Republican Party. It also has a home in the Constitution Party, and there are some elements of it in the Libertarian Party, and I think we should just advance conservatism everywhere. But for the next few election cycles, 60 to 70% of, quote, conservative voters are going to continue to vote the label, because they're not going to be that involved. We're waking them up, and more people are awake every day, but these things don't happen quickly. It'll take a few cycles, so the Republican brand is still important, and I think that we should restore it to the way it was with the ghosts of Christmas past, so that the ghosts of Christmas future can sound a lot more like Coolidge and Harding and all those other guys. Lucas, did I answer your question, by the way, about the fiscal cliff, or was I evasive?
No, not really.
Okay. Now,
no,
are you asking
what you're looking at? It's the same fear tactic, you know, the scary word, or we have to, you just played that clip from George Bush, to defend the free market system or the fiscal cliff, or he's the inevitable, he can defeat Obama. It's the same bullshit that is being shoved down our throats when nobody, and it distracts people from the actual what's really wrong. Where's the cancer? Let's cut it out, you know? Mm-hmm. And so my, you know, to, back to the original question, I'm sorry I derailed this conversation.
No, you didn't.
But what is it, and what is going to be the consequences if we don't, you know, if Boehner, and I'm hearing this narrative that, oh, Boehner, he's so brave, he's trying to work it out, we have to do something because it's the fiscal cliff.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just a tactic to shove through whatever crap legislation so they can pretend like they're trying to fix it. And nobody even understands the real problem.
And they do this at this time every year. They were talking about this, too. Remember, trying to scare folks, saying that, oh, Social Security's not going to get paid. Medicare's not going to get paid. Folks on unemployment, you know, that's going to get cut off. So they use that scare tactic.
I was in Iraq, and I still got my paycheck.
Yeah. All they've got is fear tactic. That's all they've got, fear tactic.
And talk about getting rid of Boehner, I think another cancer to get rid of would be Rince Priebus. I think he needs to go, too. I think that'd be...
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, part of it. And
Yep, it's a very good point about Rince Priebus. Of course, that's different because you're not calling your congressional representatives and hammering them about getting rid of it because it's party people. I think it's the Central Committee or the National Committee or whatever
mm-hmm.
they call it. So you've got to get that. That he's got to go. But look, the simple fact is all they have is fear tactics because they want to be the party that stands in opposition to the Democrats as opposed to leading on something. Because if they led on something, they would have to lead on something different than what the Democrats are doing. And since we have a duopoly, they actually have the same agenda. Now, that doesn't mean that every Republican has that agenda, because every Republican doesn't. Justin Amash certainly doesn't. Rand Paul certainly doesn't. So there are Republicans who don't have this agenda, but overwhelmingly the party leadership has the same agenda as the Democrats, so this is just fear tactics. Now, what is the fiscal cliff? It's a stupid tactic that they put in place by having sunset provisions on tax cuts. I mean, you set the new tax rate, and then you let another Congress change it. Instead, what these fools did was they cut the tax rates, and then they put a sunset expiration on it just to create this problem. And that was the stupid thing to do, because what they should have just said
to happen.
Yeah, it was engineered to happen. But when they lowered the tax cuts from the rates Clinton had raised them to, the quote Bush tax cuts as they're called, they put sunset provisions in them instead of saying that these are just the new tax rates, and if you want them raised, then in the future Congress you'll actually have to have the balls to raise them. Instead, if they do nothing, they give you a tax.
It just expires.
Right. They keep telling you the Bush tax cuts are going to expire. Well, what do you think that means? That means that it's a tax hike, and it's a huge tax hike in addition to the Obamacare taxes. The other side of the coin is that they, you know, had this commission come through with this sequestration where there are automatic cuts across the board in the Democrats' favorite social programs and the Republicans' favorite defense wealth transfers to the defense contractors. And so that was supposed to be in there to pressure Congress into actually getting the problem fixed, which is just a gimmick because these cuts are mostly cuts in gains. Okay, it will not go back to any real manageable level, but at least it'll be a cut. And the fact is, we're looking back at when Newt shut the government down. You know, the spending was $1.6 trillion that he was trying to cut back from. And he had a plan to get to balanced budgets within 7 years, and he actually passed four budgets. Granted, it was baseline budgeting, which is Washington bullshit because it's not really balanced. But those were the closest we've seen to truly balanced budgets in our lifetimes, and he was able to do that. But back then it was $1.6 trillion. Today, Obama's deficits are considerably above that, and Harry Reid, that insipid pussy who also should be replaced by his own caucus, hasn't submitted a budget in 4 years, so we got all these stupid continuing resolutions so that they can have these political ploys to frighten us every now and then. It takes resolve to get this done. It's going to take a lot of power from the states, and actually in the article that we'll hopefully get to next week, Newt talks about using the states as models, especially since we've got 30 Republican governors and we control the legislature and the governorship in like 24 states. So there's a lot of work to do, and people like Newt Gingrich, who are putting these proposals, basically causing conservative pressure inside the party. You've also got people like Amash and Rand Paul. Then you've also got massive power from outside the party. You got the Constitution Party that can put pressure on the Republicans. You've got Ron Paul. Once he's out of Congress, he's going to be like Obi-Wan Kenobi. He's going to be more powerful than they can ever imagine. You got Jim DeMint, who just resigned from the Senate and moved over to the Heritage Foundation. He's going to be taking pot shots at these rhinos from there, too. So What we have to do is support the positions of these conservatives both in and out of the party. And we have to take positive action, not only to tell them what it is that we want, but to put pressure on getting rid of people like Boehner and Priebus and holding others to account. The most important thing you can do also is just wake somebody up. Have a conversation with them. Tell them about what's going on and how things are happening and what they can do, because this is going to require at least 25 to 30% of the country to realize that the system is broken and that we can do something about it by returning to the principle these Republicans from the 18th century and the early part of the 20th century were saying. We can return to that authentic conservatism and restore the republic, but it's going to take a massive effort. We got about 14 minutes of show left, so why don't we run down with some final thoughts on this, you know, theme of Republicans past, Republican present, and where we're going. And why don't we start with Lucas and then go to Robert and then Chris.
Thanks for letting me join in. Great theme, by the way. The show was amazing until I chimed in. And, that's about it. Thanks for clarifying that. You guys are brilliant, as always. And Merry Christmas. I'll turn it over.
Awesome. Well, Merry Christmas to you. Thanks for calling in. You did not derail the show. You made a fantastic contribution. Sometimes there's this problem. It's called the curse of knowledge. If you know something very well or you understand something very well, you often can't communicate it adequately to those who may not be as well-versed because you're so far down the line. So you bringing up a point saying, well, yeah, you know, you really didn't answer my question. I'm pretty sure that if someone had been involved, and I basically chat with your dad every day, he and I are kind of in tune and on the same page, so he probably got it. But if you haven't had that conversation, then it would seem like some facts were missing. So you actually had a very valuable contribution because you forced us to really bring the point down. And this is why Newt is such an effective speaker, because he doesn't suffer from the curse of knowledge. I mean, he does, but he also has a way of bringing it down and articulating it so that even if you didn't have all the background knowledge, you would get it. And that's what makes him an effective communicator. And that's possibly one of the reasons why Ron Paul is often seen as kooky or confusing, because most people know nothing about economics. And if they have any formal training in economics, it's Keynesian economics. So when Ron Paul speaks in Austrian economics terms, it doesn't fit in the paradigm and you can't quite understand what he's saying. So I strongly recommend that everybody, before the New Year's out, start studying this stuff. A great place to start is Mises.org, the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Just go there and you'll find plenty of information. The best place to start as far as a book goes, and you can get it free at Mises.org, is Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. It is simply written. Anybody who can read English can understand it, and it'll give you a background in economics that is better than 99% of the people with a piled high and deep degree in it. So, Lucas, Merry Christmas, and thanks for chiming in. Why don't we go to Robert now?
Okay, since we're doing the Christmas theme, we'll go Republican Party past. Well, when it was conservatives, such as when you had Ronald Reagan and Newt Gingrich in there, I believe that's where the party needs to go back, because Republican Party present, where you have Boehner and Rince Priebus, well, you're going to see where it's ruled by the rhinos, and you see what happens to Republicans electorally. And in order for the Republicans to be a force in the future, I believe they're going to have to go back to the past of course, their conservatism when you've seen with Reagan and Newt Gingrich. And if they do not do so by getting rid of Boehner, and that's just a start, by starting with getting rid of Boehner and Priebus, then I see the kind of future that Ebenezer Scrooge seen when he had the last ghost if he didn't change his ways.
Yep.
And that's all I got for that. And, of course, Merry Christmas, everyone, of course, again, to you and yours. Thanks, Rex.
All right. Thank you, Robert. And, Robert, do you have a upcoming schedule to share with us?
Well, I'm looking at, of course, tomorrow's Christmas Eve, and then Tuesday is Christmas. Wednesday, I'm looking to try to perhaps get something together. I do have a pretty late day work-wise, so hopefully I can get something scheduled so we can do it Wednesday night from 10 p.m. till midnight, and that is Eastern time. that's what we're looking at. And you mentioned about the article. I think we can go more in depth on the Newt Gingrich article on Wednesday. And then, of course, you said next Sunday you'd be going even further with it.
Yeah, we're obviously, it was something I meant to do tonight, but we had a good conversation without it. But I suggest that everybody read it. And, you're going to listen to Bard's Logic to hear more about it, and then we'll get into it next week also. Next week, obviously, Sunday is the 30th, so it will be our last show prior to the January 3rd vote. So I encourage everybody, get on Twitter with Fire Boehner, hashtag Fire Boehner. Get on Coalition of Freedom. There's also another Facebook page, Dump John Boehner. There's good information there. Wake your friends up. Make your calls to your representatives and other congressional critters, and let them know that this guy has guts to go. Thank you both for calling in, and Robert, we'll see you on the air.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Rex. Take care, everyone.
All right, we're rounding out the last, few minutes. Well, we got 9 minutes left. So I think we have another caller up. They haven't hit the button. So if you've called in and you want to come on the show, just hit number one, and it'll let me know that you want to come in. But, Chris, do you want to tear it in and kind of summarize what you and I have talked about today?
Yeah, I think you did what needed to be done, and that was to clarify, what a true conservative Republican is supposed to be. And that was excellent that you brought up the ghosts of presidents past. That was great. And people, I encourage people, study history, read, understand this stuff, understand where our country came from, and understand the transition points, moving forward to what made our country great, and also what helped lead us to the path that we're here today. And it isn't just the Democrats' fault. And that's what I think history will teach you. Don't even get me started on Nixon and the gold standard and the EPA, which was the backbone mm-hmm. for Agenda 21, Department of Education, OSHA and Planned Parenthood. Hello, folks, Republican. God, it just mm-hmm. frustrates me when people doggedly, defend these people when by all standards, they are traitors to what we believe in, and understand that difference. Now, here's the future. I really believe that Newt says it. I really want to get into this article because, I started highlighting and making notes and stuff, prepping as fast as I could because we were going to discuss it. But it's important to understand this. Newt really highlights what these Republican states have done because that's the part of the Tea Party wave that we don't talk about on national politics that much unless there's a big union debacle, like with Walker or the current one that's going on. But when you look at the success of the Republicans or the conservative Tea Party Republicans in the state levels, that's the future. Gingrich understands that because that's how he made the Republican Revolution a success. He started at the state level. So I think Newt's brain is on the right track. And I know that we are more states, driven people anyway in this group. So I think this is going to be a very interesting to see where old Newt's going with this. And I'm looking forward to actually finishing this article because it's deep. It's a big article. So great show, Rex.
Well, I appreciate you coming on and sharing it with me. And, we miss Tex being here. He was on special assignment, but he's here in spirit. And, I think we got a lot of history in place, and I think that's important. It really is, if you haven't read Charles Dickens, it really is a great story, and there's a lot of lessons to be learned in there. But I think that the idea of knowing where you're coming from and where you are and where you want to go, that's the only way to move through life in general, and certainly it's true for us as a country and for our political lives together. If you don't know where you're coming from, then you can't learn from the mistakes of the past, and you can't learn from the things that you did right. And the fact is that don't point fingers at this guy or that guy and say he's all bad or he's all good, because it doesn't work that way. I can point a lot of things that Newt Gingrich has done that I don't like. I can point a lot of the things Ron Paul does that I'm not too keen on. Okay, I could probably do the same thing with McKinley and Coolidge and Taft and all of them. But find the ones where you have a dominance of agreement, and build those coalitions, because the very simple fact is the Republicans in the past were truly conservative. So are the Democrats, for that matter. And then they lost their way. The Democrats went completely socialist, and the Republicans went to where the Democrats were. We've lost the conservative voice here. The Constitution Party has a conservative voice, okay? But most people are still so brainwashed by the duopoly that they're going to vote for an R or D or jackass or a rhino or elephant. So, you know, we've got some cycles before we get that, and I know Robert's done some shows on multi-party systems and correcting our voting processes, and that's something that we really need to all work on. Unfortunately, there's only so much time, there's only so much effort, and right now the key thing to do, because they are in power and we don't have an election for another 2 years, the key thing to do is to get rid of John Boehner so that we can have a real conservative, or at least someone considerably more conservative, and it's not Cantor, it's not McCarthy, it's not Ryan, in the speakership, which is the most powerful position when it comes to spending in the country. And we need to get rid of Rince Pubis so that we can move forward. And as we correct ballot access and the voting processes in the country, then we also need a Republican National Committee that is committed to putting forward a positive agenda of true, authentic conservatism that appeals to everybody beyond race, religion, sexual orientation, or whatever the hell else you have that they use to divide us and keep us pitted at each other's throats so that they can take over everything without us. Now, you know, we've talked a lot about a lot of interesting things. Please go to the Tex and Rex show page on Facebook and like the page, and that way you will be able to get updates of when we're broadcasting and that kind of thing. And also you will find the videos, clips, articles that we're talking about there as well. So that's the Tex and Rex show on Facebook. And we will be back here 10 p.m. Eastern, Sunday, December 30th. And we'll be hopefully talking about the Newt Gingrich plan for the future of the Republican Party, and as well as getting rid of John Boehner. In the meantime, we're about 24 hours away from Christmas, so we're going to end with a positive message of hope. And the hope is that this is your country. Out of 7 billion people currently alive, you're one of 300 million that are Americans. It's a privilege and it's a duty. You have to act like the American you are privileged to be. You are responsible for what we do in this country, because you have the power. Even if the votes aren't counted and there's cheating and all this kind of stuff, you still have the power. These people can only ruin the country either by your consent through silence or your consent through complicity. But if you stand against them and you're active about it and you make your calls and you get others involved, and it's not just about holding up a sign, it's about getting things done at the local level and also putting pressure on the federal level, then you can make a change. And this is a season of hope. Keep in mind that as we celebrate Christmas, we're talking about eternity, the infinite God breaking into time as a little baby. And not too long after that, the oligarchs of the time, principally Herod, sent his stormtroopers out to slaughter every male under the age of 2 in Bethlehem, because he was afraid of the competition that Christ, the king, would give him. And, you know, thankfully, due to the message of an angel, Joseph and Mary and Jesus were able to flee into Egypt. But those holy martyrs, those holy innocents, were all slaughtered. Now, granted, it wouldn't be a huge number. It would probably be about as many as were slaughtered in Connecticut last week. And you have to keep in mind that children are dying. People are affected by our politics. And it's up to you to do something about it. So like our founding fathers, take this season of hope with Christ in your heart and pledge your lives, your fortunes, and your sacred honor for the cause of liberty. We wish you a very Merry Christmas on behalf of the Tex and Rex Show. This is Rex. The flames of liberty will never die. See you next week.
No, no.